Accession number 24193, Reel 3.
Mr. Towle, Reel 3. Now, you went to Sandhurst in January 1949 for the 18-month course. What do you remember about your reception at Sandhurst? How did they take you in and settle you in into it?
Well, we arrived. We were allocated to various colleges. There were three basic colleges: Old College, New College, and one other. I've just forgotten that. I was posted to New College, and within New College, various of the famous battles of World War II, the houses were named after them. Alamein, mine was Normandy Company. And my intake was intake 5, being the fifth after the war in this new set of procedural qualifications like the 18 months. So I was posted into New College. The other college was Victory College. And I got that wrong. It was Old College, New College, and Victory College. I was in Victory College, of which Normandy was my house. And Victory College had the names of the famous battles, Alamein and so on. There, life began as hell.
In what way?
One never had time to do anything. Everything was at the double. Standards were very high in personal turnout, personal behavior, personal attention to detail, and attention to work. One spent about 50% of one's time furthering your education in all subjects: a language, history, geography, English, and common sense issues like banking. How do you balance a checkbook? How do you balance accounts? Because as officers, you would be in charge of impressed accounts, or balancing the officer's mess or the sergeant's mess, accounts and funds. So maths, simple accounting standards, and of that 50% of classroom time, I would think 30% was what I would call on academic subjects, all of which you had to achieve what seemed to us then a very high pass rate. The other 20% to make the 50 was of military theoretical subjects, such as map reading. Very high standards of map reading were required. Military law. You had case role playing of being a defending officer, being the accused, being the prosecutor, understanding of military law, of leadership, theories and practices. And one worked very hard. One had to pass each term and qualify. I remember language. I thought that French not being my strong subject, but I had to have a language. I didn't know what to do. And I suddenly thought, well, Russian would be quite rare. Maybe I could do quite well at Russian. I'd had no background in it whatsoever. I thought perhaps there wouldn't be many students taking it. And I thought perhaps, well, I might have rather more time to spare to do other things. I'd go to London for the weekend, like to concentrate on other subjects. And so I proudly put down Russian. It was probably my worst mistake, because on the staff, the directing staff of the Royal Military Academy of Sandhurst, were many Russian former generals or senior officers who were language teachers. So instead of having a lot of time, one had an over percentage of instructors in the language and very few pupils. So I had very little time. And it seemed to me, I remember having three tutors in Russian. Well, one in literature, one in language, and one in something else. conversation.
Did you make much progress at it?
Well, I passed to such an extent that when I passed out of Sandhurst and I got through it, but when I passed out of Sandhurst, I was actually going to go and be sent to Paris for a year or so to live with a Russian family and really have a good knowledge and ability of Russian. There is a rule in the British Army that those sort of unusual postings are cancelled when your unit is warned for active service. We were warned for active service.
And we'll come on to this. But yeah. So what else was on the syllabus at Sandhurst?
Obviously, discipline, marching, barrack square stuff.
How did you take to drill? We've not talked about drill much. Did you, as a young man, understand and enjoy or whatever drill? Did you know why you had to do so much of it? Did you know what it was for?
I didn't at the time, but I did then. I didn't in the OTC, except I could see it. It was a team-building exercise, I thought. But what happened at Sandhurst was that, A, you were being taught how to create a cohesive unit, I think. Particularly a very high standard, very advanced stuff with advancing in royal salutes, slow marches, complicated parade ground, formal stuff. But here the addition was you were then told to get out there and drill the squad with the sergeant major standing in your right ear and telling you that was an incorrect command. And you then saw life from the other side. And that was very interesting. One was fearful when one got out there and told to march the squad over there and call them back again. And one worried if your voice was going to carry and turn the squad round. And were they going to turn round when you told them about turn? And one was surprised when it did work. So one had discipline of that sort. And also had horse discipline. We had horses to ride. And
were you taught to ride? I mean,
yes, we were taught to ride. And that's where I learnt to ride. And that's helped me in Germany with the Royal Norfolk Regiment later. there it was quite fierce. And you rode, and you rode fast. But often if you weren't good, and you needed more practice, you'd be sentenced to extra time. And one of the common punishments was to have your stirrups crossed in front of you while you were on the back of this ferocious beast. And then there'd be in the school, there would be low jumps. So you'd do half an hour's low jumps with your arms folded, your legs obviously astride the horse with no stirrups, and steering the horse, and without reins. Quite hard. Then you would have to do similar exercises, holding a sword, but with no stirrups. And that was, again, quite tricky. We were taught how to drive. We taught about motor cars.
Could you drive before that?
No. We taught about the internal combustion engine. We were.
Did they teach you just on the car, or did they teach you the lorry and the things like the Bren carrier?
And they taught you about the 1500 weight truck, the Bren gun carrier, and the motorcycle. And you had to graduate in all and pass in all three, both civilly and militarily. So you had to get a civil license as well as a military license and have a basic understanding of the internal combustion engine. Charmingly, you also had to know about the discipline of getting a unit to ride a bicycle, which I think is quite charming now, but you would have, I remember the order, prepare, you got your pedal at the top, marching along, mount, you put your foot on the top of the pedal and swung your leg over the saddle, and you all should then be upright, and then you forward, and off you went. That was quite unique, and we enjoyed that. Personal standards were very high. You had your own room, which was great.
What was the room like? I mean,
small, had a window, a desk against the window, a typical army bed, and a wardrobe, and very pleasant. Bathing facilities down the hall. But you were constantly changing uniforms. You were constantly, you know, being ready to change. You were having your room inspected. You were having you inspected.
Can I ask about the sort of military tactical training? Did you do much work on military history? And if you did, what did you centre on? I mean, was it traditional military history, things like Napoleon, or was it First World War based, or was it Second World War based, or was it all three?
Military history didn't come into the first term, I think, was about settling you in, making sure you understood what you were there for and the standards expected. The terms then went on, and military history started, but it was not World War II, it was not World War I. It was more Waterloo, it was more... I think it was the 19th century military history. It was India. It was South Africa, the Boer War, but not World War I at all, and I don't remember World War II at all, strangely. But the Boer War, the problems of administration and supply... And maybe they were trying to get that across. Maybe
they were looking at the lessons behind military history,
yes.
Not just learning it parrot fashion.
Oh, absolutely. And one, you know, what were the problems? What would you have done differently? And how would you have handled it? What was the problem here? Why did we not do well in, you know, the Battle of Omdurman? We happened to do very well there. But World War I didn't come in. I think it was too big and too complicated. For the time allowed.
And what about tactics? The sort of tactics you were taught. What were the theoretical base of it, and how was it taught to you? And what were the methods you were taught? Because it's really only platoon officer, isn't it?
Yes. You did platoon tactics, covering fire, sections moving under its own support. That was the initial initial step. Then it was using covering fire with guns, 25-pounders, with other support weapons like 3-inch mortars, like 4.2-inch mortars. And as the time at Sandhurst, you graduated to moving not battalions, but brigades, and then, curiously, divisions. And it's often said, and I think a lot of us felt this, that as you left Sandhurst, you were probably immediately better generals without the experience than you would be platoon commanders, because you arrived in your platoon still thinking in a higher plane of moving brigades, of where's the artillery? Well, of course, in a platoon, you're concentrating on your own men and how you all fit in. But Sandhurst, we had a lot of games at Sandhurst.
With the tactical training, how did they teach it? I mean, was it the sand tables, chutes, and sort of practical exercise? What did they do?
Yes. I think the sand tables and chutes were very much part of our life. Probably more chutes than actual physical running around.
How did sand tables and chute work actually work? Do you see what I mean?
You were given situations to handle. You'd probably have a demonstration of here was a problem, here's how where the enemy are, here's where we are, we want to cross this river and get to that objective. This is how one would do it, so one would have an example. Now, in 3 days' time, you'll be given an exercise. Groups of you would form together in little syndicates, and you would then attack the problem, come up with your own solution in the team, and then one of you would be called forward to speak about and to move and the rest of us would move the units according to the speaker. It taught you, I think, to be able to enunciate your wishes and your ideas. Tactical exercise without troops took a lot of time, and I'd rather forgotten about that issue, but they took a lot of time. I think exercises on the ground were there, but largely larger, you know, the college would be out on an exercise, and we would all play parts of either the enemy or the other side, and we would then be awarded points and so on as to how we did. There was always a post-mortem. There was always a critical review of how did it go, how could it have been done better, and of course all the staff were skilled, experienced survivors of the war who had met all of this before, because you couldn't call up the armoured column because it had been destroyed, or it couldn't cross the bridge. What do you do? You were running out of ammunition. What do you do? Well, you call for more. Well, you can't because it had been destroyed. What do you do? And you were advancing so well, and suddenly you hadn't got the support. Or you come to a minefield that wasn't there. The strategies of minefields were very, I remember, concentrated on. And how do you lay them? And that came in Korea too, quite significantly later. The military training, military experience was all by trial, error, and debate and criticism. And it was, you know, and there is, as we all know, there is no perfect or correct solution for any set of circumstances, but the optimum. And even most people would agree to disagree about the optimum course. And that I found fascinating. And I found that if you reviewed and understood the situation and made a decision and acted upon it, you were generally better off than trying to overanalyze and overcritique, having overcritiqued the thing before. I found at Sandhurst you did better if you said, okay, this is the problem. As you understand it, this is what we must do, then you get on and do it. An awful lot of people spent a lot of time on the analytical side. And it was interestingly, those then, I noticed, began to go to the service units in their subsequent career, like the Royal Army Service Corps, the Ordnance Corps, the services, the tanks, the cavalry, the armour, the infantry, tended to make more rapid decisions and get on with it. I think that's as far as the military side goes.
What about at the mess? I mean, you presumably would be introduced to, not saying you wouldn't know how to behave as an officer in a mess, but was there any element of introducing you to the mess and how to behave, drinking habits, that sort of thing?
Very much so. I think every Friday was guest night at the Royal Military Academy. It might have been Thursday. And you changed into your dress uniform. You were allocated seats. You would have somebody from Old College or New College next to you instead of just Victory College. And the etiquette, you either learnt by example and experience, and the staff sat amongst you, that's right. And you began to learn when to talk, when not to talk, when to... some of the regimental customs of receiving the port from the right and passing it to the left, the snuff-taking, the methodology and the time-honoured process. Almost an unconscious school in manners.
Were you warned not to drink too much or taught how to drink enough?
I don't remember ever being taught not to drink. I don't remember drink ever being a problem. I think at that time, in the 49s, 50s, one hadn't the money, one hadn't the time, And it generally wasn't a thing as it is today of social behaviour. Certainly you went to the mess and you would meet before dinner at Sandhurst in your college, and you would... I remember the etiquette of saying good evening to the senior officer present, and you stayed there until you were acknowledged. So you'd go into your the pre-dinner cocktail reception, and you go up to the senior officer as you arrived, and you generally were there first, but if you arrived a bit later, you would go up and you stood there and you would stand to attention and just attract his attention, a slight bow, and he would a slight bow to acknowledge you, and then you would have a sherry, something very modest, certainly only ever one, and you might on occasion, special occasions, have a glass of wine for dinner. But I don't remember any loutishness, any excesses, any drinking clubs. Pubs weren't encouraged. Camberley couldn't handle. You know, the Sandhurst cadets being let out with their vast number. And so I don't ever remember, certainly in the junior terms, I think in the very last term, you got out more, and you generally went to London. And, of course, you had to have your bowler hat. Because, and I often wondered about this, if you met a senior officer, how were you going to acknowledge him? You not acknowledged him by raising your bowler hat. And people were punished for not having their bowler hat. I remember that very clearly, very clearly. And the bowler hat can get in the way, you know, when you're trying to enjoy yourself. But socially, it wasn't a time of great social expansion.
You didn't make many... I was going to ask that almost the next... Did you make many good friends on the course?
Yeah. Within one's college, yes. Small number, and I know them today. Perkins, Lumsden, Scots Guards, Perkins of the Royal Lincolnshire Regiment, Leicestershire, Royal Leicestershire Regiment, who was happened to be in career, and a small number, half a dozen. Socially, in my college, you had really aristocrats, small number, you know, the Marquis of this, the leader of the clan of the MacDonalds, or something, as young men. And there were those group, the Earl of so-and-so. They were there. And, you know, they were, you know, very pleasant to be with. But they were one group. And then there was the middle group of us. I found in the middle group that one had... people there were foreign students as well in that middle group, people from the Middle East who were qualifying. They were very interesting, and we were fascinated to have them. But socially, of course, they didn't belong anywhere, so we'd try and pick them up and take them with us. But this middle group was a very interesting cross-section, I think, of Britain at the time. You had, you know, Scots, you had... people from the south of England, from Wales, Irish, Northern Ireland, were very strong in the forces at that time.
What about the class range? Because, I mean, I accept what you say about the Marquess of this and that, that they are obviously different from... But did what was the mainly public school boys or good grammar school boys, or was it more mixed towards people who perhaps come up from the ranks?
It I think, was almost exclusively public school at that time. You know, there were lesser public schools and great public schools. There were those that had come from the, let's call them the colleges, the technical colleges, and they were very good and very hard workers and very strong technically. I don't remember many from the ranks, but if you like, I was from the ranks and would be that exception. But I was never known to be from the ranks, which I clearly was. And I think there might have been one or two who had gone through the WASB from becoming a soldier first. And I was really rather proud of that achievement in the social order of the day. But the foreign students were a lot of fun. And I love the sergeant, I loved the sergeant major's description when they spoke to you on parade. You know, you were an officer cadet and supposed to be a gentleman, and you were to be addressed by the sergeant major as officer cadet so and so, officer cadet Towel, and you referred back to the sergeant as sergeant or sergeant major. But when it came to those with titles, they had to say Officer Cadet McLaren of McLaren, or Officer Cadet the Marquis of whatever, or even some of the foreign students, Officer Cadet Prince Rachid al-Amina. And so this, and the lovely little stories of, you know, Mr. Officer Cadet Towel, Mr. Towel, they could use as well. Am I hurting you? Those lovely little stories. Well, no sergeant major or no staff. Below sergeant major, the word staff was used. No staff. Well, I should be. I'm standing on your hair. Get it cut. You know, those sort of things. But generally speaking...
What about the drill instructors, the NCOs? How did you get... Well, there was one or two famous ones, a chap called Britton, I think.
Britton. I was there with...
What were these people like?
Oh, I think magnificent. They were all ferocious, superficially, and cuddly teddy bears thereafter. And you got to know them, and they got to know you. And... the roaring and the ferociousness was required publicly, and we all obeyed it. But if you happened to be walking, marching beside one, and one would come up and he would say, Mr. Dahl, come on, pull your stomach in, or swing your arms better than that. Oh, come on, roar! Stand to attention, everybody, you know, stand upright! But a nice little sort of gentle pat on the back. Now that's better. Better, Mr. Dahl, that's better. Just keep it up.
Why did Britton become so well known? I've forgotten his first name now, but it was RSM or it was certainly a company sergeant, senior NCO.
He's a regimental sergeant major. RSM Lord, Britton, and then RSM Lord, I think, came after him. And I have forgotten his name, but he got us through the sovereign parades. He got us through. Every term there was a complete parade. And Sovereign's Parade, when there was a graduation I think it was always in June, and the adjutant rode his horse up the steps and so on. The staff, the NCOs, were very smart, very good, elegantly turned out with a red sash across their left shoulder. And they had, I think, no visible humanity. No visible sensitivity at all. The senior NCOs, the regimental sergeant majors, and there was one for each college. And then the super regimental sergeant major, like Britton, like Lord. And they were human. They got there. They were going to make sure you performed. And if you performed, you were with them. But the other sergeants were... They were struggling to go up. They wanted to be perfect, better than the next group. And that created quite a spiral of quality up. But there wasn't time for milk of human kindness at that level.
Now, what about PT, the physical side of training? I'd forgotten to mention that earlier. But, you know, the getting you fit, physically fit. How was that done?
In two ways. There was, firstly, the sports and games and cross-country runs, and there is an event which I still sort of remember very with much surprise that one actually achieved it. It was called the Wish Stream cross-country run, and it's put around the grounds of Sandhurst through the Wish Stream, hence